Those of you who were here last evening know that we're in for a treat with Dr. Mark Jarhouse here this afternoon. Dr. Jarhouse completed a BA in philosophy and art from Calvin College. Yes, you heard right. He did an art degree and painting and pen and ink drawings, the area that he enjoys expressing that art. He also did an MA in clinical psychology, an MA in theological studies. He has a PsyD, a Doctor of Psychology. He has many academic reasons why he should be here with us today. If you were here last night, you also recognize that he is a researcher, not someone who only does research himself, but has looked at research carefully enough and often enough that he is asked to critique the research of other people. But he is also a devoted Christian. And it is in that capacity in particular that we welcome him here today. And so he will be speaking to us on a very interesting topic: the pastoral applications of a three-tier distinction between same-sex attraction, a homosexual orientation, and a gay identity. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Jarhouse.
Well, it's been a delightful conference so far. I hope that you are getting as much out of it as I am. I stay so often in my field that I don't get the opportunity to look at other fields and how experts in those areas are wrestling with issues, and so I'm grateful for that, for a day to have that, a couple of days to do that together with you. I want to talk today about doing counseling and pastoral care, realizing that I'm not a pastor, and so I will likely learn from you again on ways that those challenges may be different. I will speak as someone who, you know, is licensed in the state to practice in a certain domain of competence, and so that puts a different spin on some things. But I wanted to, I wrote an article a few years ago on this three-tier distinction and published it in a pastoral care journal for pastors, and the reception was very favorable among those who provide care in this area, so I thought I would share and develop it a little further for you today. So when I talk about this topic of this three-tier distinction, one of the things that I want to begin with is introducing you to a construct or a concept called sexual identity. Because we've been talking a lot, when you heard me last night, talking about orientation and how orientation develops and whether or not it can change. And I found it to be more relevant in my counseling and in pastoral care to talk about identity. So sexual identity refers to this act of self-labeling. I should say, as you're scrambling to find this, I do have a paper in there that's like what I'm going to do here, but I'm going to share more with you than what's in the paper because I just feel compelled to just keep working hard for you and keep doing it more. Okay, so a little bit more background here that's in the paper, but you'll be able to follow the main concepts in the paper. So it's the act of self-labeling, and it's labeling how you identify your preferences to yourself and to other people. So we could talk about a private sexual identity and a public sexual identity. People will by default assume someone is straight unless they give them reason to think otherwise. There's a public sense of sexual identity that way. And a person could privately think of themselves as gay or bi, but publicly identify themselves as straight. So there's different ways to think about sexual identity that way. But it's that act of labeling yourself. Now, a little more complicated answer would be this, that there are many things that may contribute to the decision to select one label over another. Why say gay or bi curious rather than straight? Why make one label over the other? And I think there's many things that may contribute to it. I offer you a few here, but I think it has to do in part with if you're born male or female could contribute to your labeling later, how masculine or feminine you feel. We call that gender identity. Your sexual attractions, clearly those are going to play a role in your identity label. Your intentions, what you intend to do with the attractions that you have. Your behavior, what you actually do that puts a stamp, in a sense, on your identity over time, and your beliefs and values about sexuality and sexual expression. And that's not to say that There aren't other things that a group this size could come up with, but these are some things that I think contribute to the act of labeling and selecting one label over another. Visually, if you're a visual learner, I give it to you this way. Just the idea that these could be weighted differently for different people. So what I do when I meet with someone is at some point early on in my meeting, I'll give them this pie chart, a percentage, an opportunity to list the in percentage form what relative weight these things carry in their own sense of labeling their identity. And so here's an example where somebody said, my attractions to the same sex are trump for me in terms of labeling myself. The fact that I'm born male or female, intentions, values, gender identity, they have relative weight there, but my attractions are trump. And some of the common labels, gay, straight, bi, bi-curious, queer, questioning, curious, there are a number of labels. And I will tell you as a researcher, many young people today are choosing not to label at all. And so when people do research, when people like me do research and have categories for people to put checks on boxes and they say, I don't label myself anymore, now we add that to our research and we put no label or other, or please elaborate because we're trying to quantify something. Okay, so, but it's an interesting challenge. Many more young people are choosing not to categorize themselves in the labels that have been very common in our culture. How is identity related to the whole thing I was doing last night on orientation? I think it's helpful to make the following three-tier distinction between attraction to the same sex, orientation, and a gay identity. So I try to illustrate this visually here, is that the majority of people, when you survey, will talk about themselves as attracted to the opposite sex. But in a national survey, about 6% of men, 6.2% of men, and 4.4% of women reported feeling attracted to members of the same sex. But when you ask about orientation, only 2% of men and 1% of females, males and females, report a homosexual orientation. So what's the difference? The difference appears to be in the degree of attraction. How much attraction do you experience? And is it sustained over time? Does it persist? And I don't know, if I gave you a scale from 1 to 10 and said, where would you rate your intensity of your attraction to the same sex? What number would magically qualify you to say it's my orientation? I don't know. It's quite subjective that way. But if you think of the intensity of your attraction, how durable it is, how persistent it is over time, and if it was strong enough towards the same sex, and I gave you a survey, you might say to me, that's my orientation. Okay? Homosexual orientation. So it's possible to be attracted to the same sex and not have the attractions signal an orientation. That's really the main point I'm making there. The third tier in the three-tier distinction is identity. Identity, a gay identity, is a sociocultural label people use to designate something about themselves. And if you look historically and cross-culturally, there has never been a time where people said of themselves, I am gay. There's never been that level of self-defining attribution, I am gay. Now, I'm not saying same-sex behavior has not occurred in other times, other cultures, or attraction. I'm saying there was no formed identity. There was no gay movement as a subcultural phenomenon, and hence no language to convey it. And you can get that straight out of gay scholars who provide history of the gay movement. A gay identity needed sexuality to be divorced from sex as causing procreation. It needed to have ways for procreation to stop through sexual activities, so sexuality could just be pleasurable. It had to have certain gains in terms of individual rights in a culture, a sexual revolution. Other things needed to be in place for there to be a subcultural community that could designate themselves as a group and then take on a self-defining attribution, I am gay. Okay, so that's pretty well understood historically from within the gay community as well. Okay. So I think it can be helpful in clinical practice to separate these three things out, because in our culture, we collapse these three tiers into one thing. We treat it as synonymous. If you have attraction to the same sex, you are gay. We quickly move from a descriptive account of your experience, attraction, to a prescriptive account and identification. I am gay, self-defining attribution. So in one of our studies, we actually got an interesting quote that helps explain this. It says, orientation indicates, this is a research participant, someone answering a question. Orientation indicates that there is some sort of natural bend to me toward homosexuality. Identification is what sort of label are you placing on yourself? I believe that you can have a predisposition towards something. There may have been things in my life that moved me towards homosexuality, making that an easier leap than others. That would be more or less an orientation. And through that, I've had certain things happen in my life, circumstances that oriented me towards homosexual attitudes and beliefs. That orientation then led to identification. It was like, well, okay, I'm feeling this way and believing these things. That must mean I'm homosexual. These two questions together, they're not really two separate issues. They are tied together. Your orientation can lead to identification. So why do I focus then on identity rather than orientation? The traditional Christian sexual ethic, in my view, does not hinge on the causes of same-sex attraction or homosexual orientation. And I've met people who would say, if you can prove to me that homosexuality is 100% biological, then that settles the moral debate. And I have said, I don't quite follow you on that point. To me, just the opposite. I don't see that a clearer understanding of causes settles the moral debate. Even gay scholars have admitted, and one book I was reading not too long ago said, the objection that conservatives have about us has nothing to do with our orientation, which we find ourselves with. It's the behavior we engage in, which is volitional, which is we choose to do that. Okay, and so I agreed with them. That's the concern that people have within faith communities, is largely around patterns of behavior rather than attractions, although attractions obviously set the table for future behavior. Second, traditionalists who've dismissed the research on orientation do seem a bit misguided. I put ignorant there, maybe that's a little strong. But the idea that we reject any other possible causes of orientation other than a willful choice. See, I think that's a mistake. We are caricatured as saying that the cause of homosexuality is a willful choice by the person. And I told you last night, and I will tell you again, I have not met people who choose to experience same-sex attraction. They have choices to make with the attractions that they feel, but they find themselves with these feelings, and now they need guidance on where to go from here. A more robust view of sexual orientation, I think, makes social conservatives or traditionalists look sort of naive. As more research comes in those areas on orientation, I think I'm not sure I want to take a position that's so positioned against orientation being a certain way that as research comes out, it challenges the whole thing. I just think that's a mistake for conservatives. So sexual identity helps us focus on an endpoint. Sexual identity helps us focus on where we want to go as we're working with someone and where they would like to go. Identity brings to the foreground patterns of behavior and whether they're compatible with what Scripture teaches. In the end, I think identity speaks to what we treasure and of whose kingdom we're a part. But how do people get to the point where they label themselves? How do people get to the point where they make self-defining attributions? Did you know that in 1970, the average age of saying, I am gay, occurred at about age 20? 9 years ago, the average age was 15. If it's going anywhere, it's going younger. Younger and younger people are saying, this is my label, this is my self-defining attribution as I am gay. Now, to the gay community, just so you understand this, they see that as a positive step forward because you're saving young people from having that level of being closeted and confused and repressed sexuality. You're saving them from that. To social conservatives, they're very alarmed that these rates are getting younger and younger. Is 15 old enough to commit yourself to an identity label? That's the concern that usually is brought up. In these studies, about 10% did not want to be gay at the time of the survey. Most, 75%, reported feeling good about their identity. These are convenient samples, though, typically of gay youth in community centers that have outreach to gay youth. And so I'm not surprised that they're overall satisfied with their sense of their identity. Generally speaking, in the research here, females have tended to be more positive about identifying or having same-sex attractions than males have been. In one noteworthy study that I mentioned last night, females showed more ambivalence about even labeling themselves as lesbian or bi or whatever. They saw their sexuality as much more fluid, and they changed their sexual identity over time. When sexual identity develops, it's typically, when you ask for benchmarks in how identity develops over time with young people, it usually begins with this sense of attraction at a young age, followed by behavior. Behavior leads to a questioning of what does this mean about me, and then labeling myself based on the behavior and attractions that preceded this. So it's interesting to me that behavior precedes labeling, which would be another reason to delay sexual behavior. And when I counsel people, I counsel heterosexual, homosexual alike to delay sexual behavior. You are in a better place to make better decisions the older you are than at a younger age in terms of your sexual expression. But that process from initial attraction to claiming an identity label can take from months to years. It takes about 3 to 4 years for females, 5 to 6 years for males on average. But it can take as long as 15 years in some of these studies. 15 years between initial attraction and later labeling and saying, I am gay. And I've found that in our studies of Christians, it's even longer. We found that people who are Christians and struggle with same-sex attractions and take their faith seriously over time have resolved this usually in the mid-20s. For the group that I'm thinking of that was identified eventually as gay and Christian, it was about 26 years old when they, as a group, the average, settled on their identity as gay and Christian. For the group that chose not to identify as gay and said, that's not the identity label I'm going to use, but I'm going to form my identity more in Christ, that group was in their early to mid-30s. I think the average age was 33 or 34. So part of what I'm saying here is that this is a long process for young people sorting this thing out. It begins at a pretty young age. It goes through middle school and high school, through college and beyond for people who are trying to take their faith seriously. And there is adequate time there for us as a community to come alongside them and help walk this out with them. Okay? It's not a one-time critical conversation they had when they were 17. Okay? And so when I work with parents, I'm saying take a long view. Take a long view. Okay? You know, the Bill Cosby episode is, I brought you into this world, I can take you out. No, you brought them into this world, and you will sustain your relationship with them over time. You will be their mother. You will be their father over time. Let's think about how we want to respond now in light of the long term. Okay? Okay. So here are some of the milestone events from secular researchers in this area showing some of those ages for these benchmarks. Average age of 10 reported first awareness of attraction to the same sex. Initial behavior, average age of 15. Labeling, average age of 16. And then an ongoing same-sex relationship. So the initial behavior was behavior to orgasm, but not in the context of a sustained relationship. The relationship occurred later at age 18. Okay? Very interesting. Now, we studied Christians who had similar experiences, and I'll share some data on how they differ and how they're similar in terms of these milestone events here in a few minutes. So, the developmental task, think about what's going on for a young person. I just gave you an age range there between 10 and 18. What's going on during those age range? Eric Erickson suggested that during adolescence, this is a time of identity role versus role confusion, that young people are trying to figure out their identity during a critical period of time in adolescence, trying to figure out who they are. And young people will try on different roles in different settings. They'll be different at home than they are at church. They'll be different at school than they are at home. They'll try on different roles to figure out sort of who am I in relation to other people. Add to that a sexual minority or somebody who struggles with same-sex attraction and is trying to figure that out in that same developmental context of meaning. I want to understand my identity, who I am. This gets increasingly complicated for a young person, particularly if the culture tells them, I know exactly who you are. who you are is a gay person by virtue of your attraction to the same sex. And so what we've seen in the literature, in the broader mainstream gay community literature, are models of sexual identity development. How people come from a 10-year-old to a teen or older who says, I am gay. And we saw models of what I would call general homosexual identity. Then we saw models of gay male identity formation, lesbian identity formation, bisexual identity formation, ethnic minority, sexual minority identity formation. What each of these groups was saying is, we go through different experiences. We used to treat it all the same. It was just homosexual identity development. And lesbians within the gay community said, no, we have a different experience than the males do. And they were right. They do. And bisexuals said, wait a minute, we have a different experience than you guys do. And they were right. Ethnic minorities said, we have a double minority status that you don't account for in your models. And they were right. Okay? So the typical model here would be, there's a time of identity confusion, being confused about these experiences of attraction to the same sex, making comparisons to others, that I am somehow different by virtue of these attractions, tolerating the possibility that I might be gay, accepting that I am gay, going to a time of all things gay are good and all things heterosexual are suspect, and then eventually the pendulum comes to the middle and they synthesize a gay identity and realize that there's kind of good and bad in the world, both in the gay community and in the straight community. It's a lot like early models of racial identity development, if you're familiar with those models. So this is one of the, if you've got a human sexuality textbook on hand, and maybe you do, this would, if there's a model presented, it would still probably be this model from 1979, even though there's been many others. But what I was struck by when I read this literature was that there was another group that was missing from these explanations. What about people who do not identify as gay over time? What about people who get to the end of this model of identity formation and they don't identify themselves as gay because of religious reasons, for example? What about people within our communities who say, yes, I have these attractions, but I don't identify with them, or I'm not going to form my identity around them, or I choose to identify with Christ or have that be my primary identity is located there and not over here? And the only time I found them was typically they were sort of thought of as developmentally arrested, like they couldn't quite make it to a gay identity, and so they were offshoots over here. I thought, well, that's interesting. They don't seem developmentally arrested to me. I mean, they seem reasonably healthy. They're coming to see me. They just don't adopt a gay identity. Should we pathologize them for that? And it struck me that no, we shouldn't, but we should account for them in the literature. Why are they at this point? And why wouldn't we value hearing their voices in this debate? So some people do not achieve a gay identity. They disidentify with the gay community and the organizations and people that support a gay identity. They do not identify with them. Okay? Now, you could also, I make a note here, that you could transform the meaning of the word gay. There are subpopulations within the community who will adopt a gay identity simply to say, I'm attracted to the same sex, but they pursue chastity. And they say, yes, I'm gay in that way. I'm not trying to make this rhyme, but I am gay. I have these attractions, but the fact is I don't act on them, and so I'm not what you think of as part of the gay community. Okay, so I want to be clear about that. All right. Now, we've studied, I showed you some of those milestone events with community samples that secular psychologists have put together. We studied Christians at Christian colleges, three different colleges around the country, who identified as sexual minorities. And they filled out our survey and told us about these milestone events. Very similar, a little bit older age of first awareness of attraction. We asked about feeling confused about them very shortly after that. Behavior at age 16, behavior to orgasm. We asked about initial attributions. When did you first initially think that this meant you were gay? And we teased that out from eventually labeling yourself as gay and first relationships. So you get a sense for where Christians were saying, this is what it was for me. But what was very interesting, with the percentages dropped off, once you got past confusion and awareness of attractions, when you got to behavior, very few of our sample, less than a third, actually engaged in same-sex behavior for religious reasons, okay? Or attributed their attractions to a gay identity. Although more than a third thought, well, that must mean I'm gay. But look how many actually labeled themselves as gay. Less than 15% said, this is who I am. And if you're curious, this is 20% over here for relationship. So what I'm saying is there's a pretty interesting group of people out there in our schools who are walking a different path of identity formation, but they're not choosing to identify as gay. I don't know how much support we're giving them, how much support they receive from fellow Christians, but they're trying to navigate this often in isolation, I would say. Okay? Let's be honest. So we ended up conducting a study where we were looking at the intersection between religious identity and sexual identity. How do people like this make sense out of that connection between having same-sex attractions and having strong Christian commitments? How do they make this work? So we contacted organizations that represented those groups, and we worked with a group that's a very gay-affirming Christian group, and we worked with a ministry group that helps people who are leaving homosexuality. And we looked, so everybody in our study had same-sex attractions. Everybody identified as Christian. One group identified with a gay framework and said, this is who I am. And one group said, I disidentify with that. I do not identify with that. And we published it in this book. If you're looking for a second book to read on research that you're just pining for that kind of reading, called Sexual Identity Synthesis, Attributions, Meaning Making, and the Search for Congruence. By the way, my father mentioned to me, if I really want to sell any books at all, I've got to get the word research out of the title or subtitle. Maybe something like Harry Potter and the Sexual Identity Dilemma, or something like that, or Twilight, or something that's a little more hip and happening. All right. So what we found was really interesting, that those who identified as gay, they achieved a kind of congruence where they lined up their identity, their religious beliefs and values with their identity and their behavior. So the group that said, I am gay and a Christian, worked it out so that their beliefs and their values, their theology, would correspond with their identity and behavior as a gay person. And they achieved a kind of congruence by making that maneuver to make that happen. Okay? So beliefs and values, theology over here, came into accordance with their behavior and identity as gay, and they achieved congruence, and they felt at peace with that. Right? They attributed their attractions to who they really are as a person. This is who I am, would be very common language for them. They would say, it would be inauthentic for me to worship God as somebody other than a gay person because that's who I am, just to give you a sense for how it feels for them. But the other group was just as interesting, even more so to me in a sense. They achieved congruence by lining up their identity and their behavior with their religious beliefs and values. They also achieved congruence, but they made a different maneuver. Their beliefs and their values were conservative, traditional, orthodox, and they achieved congruence by bringing their identity and their behavior into conformity with their beliefs and their values theologically. And they achieved a kind of congruence by doing that. And they attributed their attractions not to who I really am as a person, but to something else. Some attributed it to the fall. You know, this is not the way it's supposed to be, to borrow from the movie Grand Canyon, right? This is not the way it's supposed to be. These attractions signal the fall. They're not what God intended for me. Okay? Others attribute it to parent-child relationships, other possible causes, but they attribute it to something that wasn't God's best for them. And the way that they achieved authenticity was they meant that authenticity was, I can't worship God as a gay person because God didn't intend for me to have gay be my primary identity. Okay, so I disidentify with the gay identity, and to be authentic, I worship God out of who I am when I'm not identifying as gay, as a person before God. So my primary identity would be in Christ, would be a very common designation for that group, in Christ. It was interesting because when we got done with this study, we sent it back to both groups, and both groups felt like we captured their experience accurately. Okay, what I want to do now is talk about some of the competing scripts that I think make this navigating this terrain difficult for young people in our churches. And then we're going to get into then what are the implications for pastoral care. I think there is something that I would refer to as a gay script that is very compelling for young people in our culture today. And the script, I think, I'm being fair here, reads something like this. Same-sex attractions signal a naturally occurring, or in Christian circles or religious circles, read that as intended by God, distinction between homosexuality, heterosexuality, and bisexuality. In some cases, they'll make that argument. So same-sex attractions signal who you really are as a person. They're at the core of who you are as a person, and same-sex behavior is merely an extension of that core. It cannot be evaluated in and of itself because it's an expression of who you are. And now we're talking about self-actualizing your sexual identity. And you have every right within a culture that screams for self-actualization to actualize your potential. And nobody has a right to limit that expression. I think that's a pretty accurate reflection of a common script for a young person who's attracted to the same sex, how to make sense of this. So I'm thinking literally of an actor on a, well, figuratively, as an actor on a stage reading a script, how to make meaning out of their experiences at a young age. So think about this for a second. You have this conflict of a young person being brought up in our churches, a young person trying to sort this out, and they experience same-sex attraction as young as age 10, 11, 12, and they're trying to make sense out of this. Who am I? What is this signal about me? And the gay community has a readily available script over here for resources answering questions about identity that are readily available to a young person. And over here in the church, very little is brought to bear on the decision making for a young person at that critical stage of their life. Very little. So we can get to pastoral care if you want to talk about giving care to someone in their 20s and 30s. But you want to go upstream and find out what's going on. You know, it's that image of people, why do I keep pulling people out of the river? Well, at some point, you got to go upstream and find out who's pushing them all in. I mean, prevention is a piece of this discussion. Now, in this discussion, we want to look carefully at how a culture may communicate something to a young person. This is who you are. And the church is saying very little about any other response. So if you could do a thought exercise with me just for a minute. You can either close your eyes or look at the screen, but I want you to envision a stage where a young person, age 13, 14, is trying to figure out what to do with the attractions that they have. They have attractions to the same sex. They did not choose to have these attractions, but they find themselves with these attractions. And that young person looks off stage for resources, for some guidance on who they are on this stage in life. And the gay community is readily available to hand them a script that says these attractions signal who you are. They're an expression of your behavior, if you want to engage in it, is an expression of who you are. It's an extension of your core identity. And you have every right to delight in that. So that's one option. They look to the other side, to the church, and they say, what can you tell me about this? And what's the church doing on the topic of homosexuality? Often it's nothing, and when it is mentioned, it's mentioned as the only sin that is going to be talked about in a special class of things that actually helps consolidate their identity because of the shame they already feel, the confusion they already feel. Well, if they're labeling people, that must be me they're talking about, and they run with that for years before they get to talk to anybody about it. Or the church is debating causes and change and these types of things, things that feel quite irrelevant to the young person who's just trying to navigate difficult terrain. Think about that young person. Now, I've presented that script to a group of Christian leaders at a conference a few years ago, and one of the presidents said, what's an alternative script? What else is available for young people today, if that is the gay script, what's a competing script? And I said, I don't know. I don't know that I have that answer. And I don't know that I should give it. I mean, why should I? I mean, this isn't an area where I'm struggling. How would I give them a script? But I've conducted research since then and asked about how people figure this stuff out who don't identify with a gay identity. And they've provided me with what I think is one possible alternative script. Okay. There may be others, but here's one. Same-sex attraction signals not a categorical distinction among types of persons, but one of many human experiences that are not the way it's supposed to be. Okay? An expression of the fall would be another way to put that. Same-sex attraction is part of your experience, but not the defining element of your identity. You can integrate your experiences of same-sex attraction into a gay identity, or you can choose to center an identity around other aspects of your experience. Now, again, we could probably come up with a couple of competing scripts. My point is the church has come up with none. And we're not competing very well with what script is readily available to young people in our culture today. Okay? So here's one that I've seen from people over years who have chosen not to identify with the gay community. Here's one. All right? And I mentioned to you that other people do a different maneuver. They transform the meaning of the word gay and they develop a different script. So we can talk about other alternatives as well. I want to note in that script two competing metaphors that I want you to think about. Two competing metaphors. One would be a discovery metaphor. I think within the gay script that I was sharing with you, the primary metaphor is a metaphor of discovery. You discover who you already are. If you give yourself enough time, you'll realize this is who you are. It's who you were. And so there's no hesitation about talking about gay youth. They used to call it pre-homosexuality. Now it's gay youth. There's no hesitation about that because that's who you are. And it's just a matter of time before you are clear about that in your own mind and announce that to your community. Okay? I think that discovery metaphor needs to be understood better for us to understand what a young person is facing in terms of a compelling script. In the other script, see, in this script of discovery metaphor, it collapses attraction, orientation, identity, and it treats them as synonymous. Because if you have these attractions, you are gay. You can just feel that three-tier distinction I made collapse into one thing. They're treated as synonymous. Now, in the other script, this one alternative script that I was seeing in the literature, the metaphor there is integration. You can choose to integrate your attractions into a gay identity. But it's not something you just discover about yourself. You can choose to integrate your attractions into a gay identity, or you could choose to disidentify with your attractions and form another identity. And that is something that's volitional. I remember meeting with a young teen. I have two consultations at our clinic, and a family flew in from out of town, and we were talking for a couple days about these issues. And the son was like 17 or 18, and he was so relieved when I said to him and to his parents that he didn't choose to experience same-sex attraction. He's like, finally, somebody's going to tell them what's going on here. Okay, and I did tell him that. I think that was true. Okay, but what he was jumping to was, I have no choice in the matter. This is who I am, and that path is formed for me and where I'm going. And look, this guy just confirmed it for you. I mean, he was already half a mile down the road on that path. And I said, look, the fact that you didn't choose to experience same-sex attraction doesn't mean you don't have choices to make now and choices to make for your future. You have choices to make not only about your behavior, but about your identity, about who you are over time. And he said, I don't want you to share that with my parents. What you did was good enough. We'll just go with the cause thing. Look, you can't pick and choose in this discussion. I know it's a burden to have the responsibility of the weight that's on you to make choices, but their choices are for you to make. And your parents have a stake in this. They're here because they love you and they want to navigate this with you. But why don't we all come together and talk about it? And that's kind of the direction we went, is talking about that together and making a decision that you can sustain over time. So it's not a question of whether this is a choice or not. There is volitional aspects about both behavior and identity. And so that backdrop of theory and research and working with Christians who struggle with this area and Christians who don't struggle with this area has led me to a framework that I want to offer to you for counseling and pastoral care. And the first thing I would do is I would protect people from assumptions and labels. And sometimes those assumptions and labels come from the gay community, the gay script, and sometimes those labels come from within the church. We can buy in to the very language I'm saying is a concern and use the very same language, and young people will adopt it and foreclose prematurely on their identity by virtue of the labels we place on them. even within the church. So I think we want to be careful about labeling. I use descriptive language when I meet with people. So you're a young person who experiences same-sex attraction. It's a little bulky, it's a little chatty, but I do use that language. Now, if they say to me, I'm gay, I don't correct them. I don't, you know, if they say this is who I am, then they've made some decisions. But I'm going to at least introduce them to that three-tier distinction because I guarantee you they've never heard it before. And I will warn you that when people hear that distinction and they've already identified as gay, they feel like it's splitting hairs. And they'll be like, come on, you're just doing some kind of word game. And that's fine. If that's the way they see it, I don't counsel to debate. I'm just working with you if you're wanting to work on this. But for people who are trying to sort out sexual identity conflicts, that creates space for them to maneuver. It creates intellectual space for them to figure out identity issues without foreclosing prematurely on one label over another. And to a person, the people I've counseled have found that to be valuable to at least create that space. Even if they've later decided, I'm going to go with a gay identity, they've at least listened to that and heard that. That's a very important first step, I think, in pastoral care and counseling. So when I do address sexual identity in my counseling, here's what I do. I follow these four major areas, the four areas that I've been sharing about. I'll start with the three-tier distinction. So I'll first do a little bit of an educational piece on that so that they understand that these differences. They don't have to agree with me. They don't have to see it the way I see it, but I guarantee you they've not heard it before. So I'll unpack that, and I'll draw on the data because we can talk about percentages of people with attraction, percentages with orientation, gay identity as a label. I'm not saying it in a derogatory way to make gay identity sound bad. I'm just laying it out in front of them. Here's the three-tier distinction. And so, generally speaking, people who are trying to navigate this terrain have found it helpful to use more descriptive language, to talk about themselves as a human being, a person in Christ, however designation they want to use, who also experiences attraction to the same sex. In other words, right there, we've shifted this away from I am these attractions to I am a person and I have these attractions. And that has been helpful to people at some stage in this initial work I'm doing here with counseling. The next thing that I'll do, and this isn't necessarily in lockstep order, but I will do this next thing, is I'll have them look at the weighted aspects of their identity. I'll look at things like the fact that you're born male, the fact that you're born female. How does that factor in to your experience of identity? The fact that, you know, if I'm working with a Christian, that God made you male, how does that factor into this? What are your intentions about this based on your values? What about behavior for you? So I'll go through a list like this and look at these weighted aspects of identity. In fact, I'm going to share with you two examples from two actual people that I counseled. One was an 18-year-old. I'm sorry, this person was a 16-year-old who identified himself as gay. And he filled out this form and he said, look, the persistence and direction of my attractions are trump for me. And my values are also pretty strong for me because I don't think this is a problem for me. This is not an issue for me. I think being gay, not a problem. Okay, so those things were very large for him. The fact that he was born male, how masculine he felt, his behavior, he'd never had same-sex behavior, never had opposite-sex behavior. But it didn't matter to him. That was irrelevant. He was a gay person. Okay. Now, a few days later, I actually met another young man who was 18, also experienced same-sex attraction. And look at the weighted differences here. For him, values, the fact that God made him male, and he also had not engaged in same-sex behavior. But this decision was intentional. It wasn't just he hadn't had opportunity. He was a Christian who said, I value chastity. And so behavior was tied to his values. And he felt that God made him male for a reason. And his masculinity was trump over the fact that he also experienced same-sex attraction. Okay? Guarantee you, he had never seen this kind of a chart before, this kind of a pie chart. He was like, really? We could pull that apart, unpack that? You're almost kind of deconstructing it in a way and looking at this and saying, what weight do you want to give this? And so what I measure over time, some people measure like change of orientation, attraction. I measure the relative weight that people give to aspects of their identity over time. Because that can change. And you say, well, what about orientation? It may change. What about attractions? They may change. What about God bringing healing there? God may very well bring healing there. But this is something that a person can make choices about. The other piece may happen. But sometimes when people focus too narrowly or too exclusively on orientation and whether or not it changes, I find that they get almost hyper-vigilant about it, checking in each week. Where is that? Nervous about fantasies, nervous about images and responses they've had to movies. Hold on. You are more than the sum of your arousal patterns to a movie you've seen. I want to think more holistically about you as a person, and I want you to think more holistically about you as a person. We can attend to the fact that you have these attractions. We can monitor them, but we're not going to become hyper-vigilant about that. Okay? If they change, you know, I know you'll be delighted in what God's done in your life, but if they don't change, you can also be delighted in what God is doing in your life. Now, what do I mean by that? I'm talking about sanctification. I'm talking about Christ-likeness. I'm talking about this part about here, about values as a major part of your identity. That many of the people that I've worked with have really focused on that part. The people that struggle the most are the people that confuse sanctification with heterosexuality. That in the final answer is that God's going to make them straight and get them married. If God does that, I understand you'll be delighted in that. But you know what? But you know what? God can do a lot with you if you never marry. A lot with you. I mean, there are many people who do not marry, many more singles who do not marry than there will be sexual minorities who do not marry. Now, I'm not preaching that to the person. I'm not making them feel shame around that. I'm inviting them into a life of sanctification. What Dallas Willard talks about is a curriculum for Christ-likeness, where no one is exempt from that curriculum. Everyone has an opportunity to grow in Christ. Okay? And orientation may or may not change. Okay? And that's a different focus. So I just want to be clear about that. All right. Now, I also, in my counseling, I'm going to look at attributions. How do they make sense of the attractions that they have? This gets back to that fundamental question that I was asking the two groups in that study. If you fundamentally say, this is who I am, and my attractions signal that, that's one thing. But if you say, my attractions are not the way it's supposed to be, they're not what God intended for me, that takes you in a different direction. And so I think, what I think of myself doing in counseling and in pastoral care, let's see if this works, is I'm joining them on an attributional search. A search for what does it mean that I have these attractions? What is God saying to me about these attractions? And where does He want me to go with it? That attributional search requires a counselor or a sensitive pastoral care provider to come alongside the person and join them on that search, knowing that God can speak to them about what these attractions mean in the larger picture of things. But do not underestimate how powerful the message is from competing voices about what those attractions signal to that young person. They are bombarded and saturated by messages, and they have very few people in their life that give them any other way of thinking about their sexuality. The last thing that here's the attribute. This is from that study I was telling you about. So this is where we get the attributions that I was sharing with you just a little while ago. The last of the major steps I do is I work towards congruence. I help them line up their beliefs and values and their behavior and their identity. Now, that's one of the differences probably between a mental health professional and a pastor, is that when you're licensed, you know, you have to make decisions then about who you're going to work with and toward what end. And you're going to look at value conflicts that may arise, and you may make referrals if those conflicts are such that you can't really, you're at risk of not helping the person, or kind of gets in the way of you helping them. But people have the right in seeing a public counselor who's licensed by the state, they have a right to see someone who will walk this out with them without saying it's got to be one direction or the other. But in pastoral care, I would envision that you have your reference point. That your reference point is in the Word of God, that your reference point is in Scripture and God's revealed will for human sexuality and sexual expression. And so congruence is living in conformity with that. And that's where pastoral care takes the basic framework here and adopts it for the unique calling of providing pastoral counsel and speaking into the life of a young person who's sorting these issues out. Okay, so there is a difference there, I think, between maybe a mental health professional and a pastoral care provider there. But I wouldn't want you to see that they're different, and so this framework wouldn't be helpful. No, the framework, I think, will be very helpful to you. In fact, you already have a reference point as a pastor, and so your care is going to be different in terms of how you deliver that care and those services. Okay. I'm going to stop there and see if I could take some questions. I guarantee there'll be questions about how we do this work.
I'm Steve Bauer from Southern Adventist University. I am linking your previous lecture to this one.
Yeah.
The distinction between the nuance between orientation and identity, and you had those who identify and disidentify.
Right.
Now, in the last year or so, I've been in a few public discussions that have got a little bit testy. And the fixation on being able to, quote, change, which is, we've already discussed, the question is this. Those who claim to be, quote, scientifically based in the discussions I have been in will argue you cannot produce evidence of change, which I think is too narrow a focus, but anyway. The problem with that is when you come to your disidentity model, they're going to say these people weren't really gay or else they wouldn't have been able to change, which in turn seems to me to undermine their science because it's no longer falsifiable because they can excuse everything as it wasn't gay if they could change. That issue of disidentity and the change question, how would that affect how you work with these people? Do you get those kind of challenges or what?
Oh, I get those challenges. let me be clear about a couple things. In this is a model about identity and not orientation. So anyone can disidentify regardless of what happens with attractions and orientation. It's a more fundamental question of identity that's a more holistic view of the person. But when I do present on change of... See, what I'm picturing is doing pastoral care with someone where the identity pieces come to the foreground and are more salient in the work that you're doing. The attractions are also being a part of that person's experience, and the attractions may diminish over time, but they may not diminish over time. But whether they diminish or not will not take away from the person sense of identity, sense of a holistic view of themselves, and sanctification. What I'm concerned about is that when a model focuses too exclusively or too narrowly on orientation and it doesn't change, the person's whole faith comes into question. They wonder where God is in all this. They wonder if they've been sold a pack of lies. They wonder if other people who've said they've changed haven't changed. They wonder, everything is called into question. And I think those are the voices of the most outspoken against the church on this issue are people who had way high expectations that were dashed, and now they resent that. And, you know, as a person in the church, I bear some responsibility in saying, what do I want to convey to the public about what people can expect? You know what? People can expect to go further into the Word, deeper into their sense of who God is in their life, into Christ. Sanctification can occur for all of us. And I have learned so much from the sexual minorities who have walked that path, even if they've not changed orientation, but they've walked that path out in great courage, often in isolation, more from them than I have many other Christians who seem to be kind of have it all together. Because you know what? These people, the people I'm talking about, every day have to say no to something that they want to do to say yes to something greater than that. And most Christians in the West, in particular, don't have to do that every day. We ought to. I mean, I'm talking about myself here, but we don't. Sorry, I'm starting to preach a little bit. I'm in the wrong profession. Okay.
It was that pastoral care application.
That's right.
Thanks, Dr. Yarhouse. My name is Deneen Akers, and I'm one of the producers of a film, and I guess we took the The Advice from Your Dad. We have a catchier title.
Okay, great.
Seventh Gay Adventist, a film about love, sex, and eternal life, which gets right to this sexual identity synthesis that you're talking about, with trying to integrate two very profound and seemingly conflicting identities. And I was really interested in sort of that journey towards labeling with the different ages where people first recognize things. It actually seems similar possibly to ages of, you know, heterosexual youth too, just trying to think back on my own life where you first start as a teenager being aware of the opposite sex or things like that. And I'm curious, a lot of the data that you presented seem to focus on, you know, 18, 17, 16-year-olds. I'm curious, for people who have chosen to use your framework to center their identities elsewhere in Christ or through the sanctification model, I'm curious if there's longer-term models when people are, say, 30, 40, and that realization of what it means to live alone without sort of that intimate companionship and emotional connection. I'm curious if there's like those long longitudinal studies.
Yeah, it's a really interesting area that I would love to study. I don't know of any such longitudinal studies. There are so few people who do research in this area, and everyone I know does not. No one has done it that I know of. We were, even when we got into people, and when I said people in their mid-30s, that study was the only one of its kind that had really looked at that. And I didn't think of it as much of a study. It was just something we were just putting together as an institute. The people I know anecdotally who are older, 40s, 50s, 60s, some I know because they're involved in a ministry of such of this kind and they want to give back to the community that helped them at a time. Some of them will talk about knowing good friends who over the years felt like they couldn't sustain it and were tired and they went a different route over time. So it's a very, it's a path that it can be very lonely. And, you know, we were talking in one of our sessions here about finding churches. How can a church become a place for people who are struggling with this? In my community, I've kind of given up on finding churches that can do that. I find pockets of people within a church. Can we find four or five people within a church who you can walk this out with? If I waited till we could find a church, we'll see that in glory, okay? But on this side of eternity, I'll take four or five people. And I remember one woman I worked with a few years ago. God bless her. She found a group of four or five women, and they did one of the Beth Moore Bible studies, and just did this Bible study together. And she grew so much in her sense of who she was as a woman, her sense of herself in Christ. She did not feel safe enough to share with them the nature of her struggle, but she did talk about a recent breakup, the devastation that happened to her. They prayed for her. They poured into her life. She's at a place right now where she's with other people who are sorting out this issue. She's able to be more transparent about the nature of her struggle. But, I mean, this was over years. And, you know, she didn't find a magic church, but she found a community. And I think that's what, you know, and so she's in her 30s, I would say, now.
Thank you. Daryl LaRue from South Africa. Just have a quick question on, it's very helpful to make the clear distinction between identity and orientation. How do you actually help someone as a pastoral caregiver just to facilitate clearly in the confusion that they have between identity and orientation?
Well, I actually have that diagram as a handout. I have a little I didn't bring a copy, but I have a little workbook called the Sexual Identity Clinic, and it's just through our institute. And it has a handout where it has those circles so that they can visually see it and see the distinction. And then I just explain, I just go over what I said to you guys here, but I try to put it in language that's a little more accessible. And I would say it takes a couple times. Not everyone gets it on the first run. And what I'll do is with this handout, most of the people I work with journal. I have them journal because 50 minutes a week is not going to help most people. But you know, they can take stuff with them and work on stuff and really take ideas. But I'll have them take that diagram, and then I have questions for them to reflect on. Have you seen this before? What does this mean to you? What are the benefits of using descriptive language? What are some of the drawbacks? What are the benefits of using a gay identity language? What are the drawbacks? So that they begin to unpack it through a series of questions, and then we'll debrief that a week later.
My question is, I have a lot of questions, I'm so sorry. My question is, that lady was talking about people who are 40, 50 years old, whatever. I like to know about children who are 10, 12 years old. This is when they're discovering or, you know, scrambling with this concept. What can we as a church do then? Because I know that they're not coming out and, you know, telling the head elder of the church or telling the deacons of the church, hey, I'm confused, I have feelings for Jane. They're not saying that. So what can we do? Because they have all this information on the internet, you know, that the gay community is providing for them. And that's what you were saying, you know, just to, you know, affirm that this is their script. Well, for 10 years old and 12 years old, they're not coming out at this stage yet they're still having access to that script. And we don't have anything for these, you know, very young people.
Yeah, I'm a little unclear, even when I look at that data, what exactly they're saying is happening at 10 or 12. Because when I think of being 10 or 12, what I think is happening is that what we're doing is we're asking adults to look back on their life and remember key benchmarks. And what they're giving us are ranges of those experiences. So when did I first feel different, or when did I first have these? And now they're calling them attractions. Were they really attractions at age 10? That's the part. So I haven't seen a study where you actually track the child over time. This is all recall based on adults looking back. So I'm a little bit, that's for free, but just a little extra thing there. But what would I do? I think it comes down to you have to work with the proximal agents again, people who are in proximity to a young person at that age in their life. So I'm thinking of at least youth group leaders, junior high group leaders, people within a faith community who work with young people. And then, younger than that, you're talking about parents and sex education. Let me tell you, I think the best resource I've ever read on sex education is Stan Jones and Brenna Jones' book, How and When to Tell Your Kids About Sex. And they have not just the book that's for the parents, but they have four books. It's a series called God's Design for Sex. And it goes through books that you would read with a young person about sexuality at different stages developmentally through those childhood years. So those years you're talking about are covered, including at one stage, I can't remember the age, they introduce the concept of a young person comes home from school and is saying, my friends are talking about gay this and gay that, what does that mean? And it gives the parent the language for explaining it. The hardest thing for parents with sex education is knowing what words to use to convey anything about this. But we know from research that young people want parents to be more involved, and this model is a model based on shaping character over the lifespan. It's not about having a talk when they're 16. First of all, you're too late. Second of all, it's not a talk because people don't make good decisions based on the content that they have in their heads. It's about the character that they have that's built over time. And that book series helps do that. So it's How and When to Tell Your Kids About Sex, Stan Brenna Jones.
I have found your presentation on the confusion about sexual orientation to be very informative and the progression in that path.
Yeah.
However, I must confess that I have difficulty in identifying with that. Because I think most people in my generation, and I speak from that reference point, have some difficulty in identifying with that confusion, because by the time I was 6 or 7, my sexual identity was not questionable. And I gained that from my parents, from my home. It wasn't something in which I gained it from some specific instruction, but it was because of the role models that my parents played. Okay. So when I became a teenager, my issues weren't over who I was. I already knew who I was. My questions had to do with what field of endeavor I would be involved in as an adult, that type of thing. My question is this. It's twofold. What degree do you feel
the disintegration of the home, family, and marriage play in this matter of confusion over sexual identity, and if that has had a definite contribution to the problem, then what role should the church play in its approach to this issue?
Yeah, it's interesting. I would probably say some of the things that I shared last night, that I think that despite the advances of people saying it's all biology that causes this, I think there are environmental factors. Some of the ones you've described may play a role, but we just don't know. And I think that sometimes what happens in the church is that we see what you describe as a disintegration of the family, and we see that as the reason for this in a direct linear cause-effect relationship. And I'm just not prepared to say that that's the cause. I think that it may be one contributing factor. I wouldn't deny that among many. But I'm open right now to the possibility of many such factors. But I wouldn't underestimate the importance of a good, stable home environment in anyone's sense of themselves and their sense of identity and their sense of their sexuality and being secure in that. I'm just not saying that if you had that, you'd prevent this. I'm not sure that I'm prepared to say that. But I do think it can be a good thing, and that's why I would point out this book, among others, as good resources for helping people as parents pour into their lives and help shape character in the areas of sexuality.
Thank you. David Hamstrom, a divinity student here. It seems to me that you're being fairly careful with the language you use in making the three-tier distinction. I'm wondering if you can comment on the importance of the words we choose. And specifically, I noticed you used same-sex attraction instead of homosexual attraction. I'm wondering if you could comment on that specifically.
Yeah. Well, I just made it because I think it's hard enough to make the distinction that once you say homosexual attraction and homosexual orientation, I thought that would muddy the water more. So same-sex is really just another way. They would be synonymous. By definition, homosexual would be same-sex. But I thought by making them linguistically a little different, it would help people latch on to that tier, that tier, that tier. So I don't know that you need really, really careful language. I haven't really got too much invested in that. But I do think that the critical distinction is probably between a gay identity and the other things that are more descriptive. Because even a homosexual orientation can be descriptive. You're just describing the way you're oriented. I just think that that there are a higher percentage of people who have attractions to the same sex who aren't oriented towards the same sex, and I wanted to make sure they were accounted for. Because young people who have a more diffuse and unfocused sexuality will often be confused by arousal to the same sex, to images, to things in movies, to the locker room, and they'll wonder about themselves. And I want to say, hold on. The fact that you had arousal, have attraction, have confusion doesn't signal an identity label. Let's make that distinction and see.
I was really struck by the contrast that you showed at the sexual identity point of the gay community information and the local church. And I guess along with that, not just the lack of support in the local church, but the homophobia in the local church. So that it's not that there is an alternative, but there is also a negative kind. So how do we begin to, I guess, turn that around and then have an alternative? Because I've always felt strongly that one of the reasons why, particularly when young people come to some of our institutions and they're in this confused state, it's because there is a vacuum in our church that sort of opens a door to all of this support and information from the gay community. So how can we do something about the homophobia and then filling that vacuum in the local church?
Well, if I had that answer, I'd be set. The church is really struggling in this area, by which I just mean us. People in our communities are struggling with this issue because no one wants to be the intolerant person who's caricatured as that way or communicated to others as that way. And I get this all the time in my field. I'm the homophobic person. I'm the heterosexualist. I'm this, I'm that. none of these people saying this about me have either met me or know my heart about these issues. And so people in the church are feeling, I think, pretty hamstrung about where to go with this, because if they speak out, they become a caricature of someone they don't even recognize. And so what they end up doing, I think, is going underground, not saying anything, not saying anything, not saying anything, until it just comes out in a much more shrill way than they ever would have said it if they could have spoken their heart. So, you know, how do you do that? You know, I'll be honest with you. What I encourage people to do is create communities that lead with grace and are open to people in their community to come, taste, see. Let the Holy Spirit work in a person's life. You build the relationship. Let the Holy Spirit convict. And then wherever you can, be in a sustained relationship with that person over time. And if you can share common interests and goals, like, you know, I mean, what do we have in common? We have a lot in common. I think it's good to work with against HIV and AIDS, and to visit people who are struggling in those areas. When you do that, you will meet people in the gay community who have a very similar love for their people. I see these people as our people. That's a fundamental difference in language that's really important for a church to adopt. If you think of the gay community as their people, or believers in our community who are also have same-sex attraction as their people, I guarantee you the gay community already sees them as their people. What we don't see them, believers, we don't see them as our people. And if we have to begin by saying these are our people, that would help transform how we would be in our churches. So.
We'll take just two more questions, one at the back and one here in the front.
By some reports, there are greater numbers of young people in high schools who are experimenting with same-sex relationships. I just wonder if you could comment on whether or not popular cultural influences, say Katy Perry's I Kissed a Girl and I Liked It, that kind of thing, whether those type of things in the popular media do they increase the amount of same sexual activity that we see?
The hardest thing about that answer to that question is there's no way to pinpoint and measure the impact of like that song or this thing or one thing. But our whole culture is saturated with those messages of sexual disinhibition. It's going to come back to what you believe about sexual orientation. If you're an essentialist, you will say it doesn't matter what your culture does, because whatever this thing is, it is central to who you are as a person. It's enduring. It's across all cultures throughout history. Culture can do what it wants. I just think that's a reductionistic view and a naive view of sexuality. I think culture does impact this area of our lives. How it does it directly, through a song, through 20 songs, through the internet, you know, why pick? We have all of it bombarding us with different messages. What I think was interesting was when you study prevalence estimates of homosexuality across the nation, you see that the estimates are lowest in rural areas, next highest in suburban areas, and then highest in urban areas. And some of that is people moving to those areas to be with like-minded other people. But it also occurs in teen age estimates. And what Edward Lauman concluded when he reviewed that data in his own study, and he's not a Christian, not a conservative Christian or anything, he said that the environment does seem to give people examples of things to try out and disinhibition for trying them out in a way that once you begin a pattern, it sets into place things that stamp on your character and your disposition over time. That strikes me as very reasonable. Now, if I say it, well, I'm a conservative Christian who gets dismissed out of hand. But, you know, thankfully, Edward Lauman said it, and I think there's something to be said for that.
We often make the distinction between orientation and behavior. So when does the behavior enter into your three-tier distinction? All three are before behavior?
You know, I didn't put behavior in there. I don't know that I was thinking of a really great rationale for that. But I was just seeing that the bigger picture was that certainly you could put behavior in there and say sometimes people engage in same-sex behavior to experiment, try something out, they're intoxicated, a lot of reasons why people might try something out, and that would be another collapse, that if you engage in this behavior, you are this type of a person. We know that people engage in same-sex behavior when they're confined and they're in prison, things like that. So you can definitely engage in patterns of behavior and not have that be an identity. You may not even have attraction, but you're capable of engaging in behavior. So you could easily incorporate that into a fourth part of this, or there's definitely room for it. But what I would say, again, same principle, is that the behavior doesn't signal identity. They would be need to be pulled apart and looked at each independently.
Last question. I may have missed it, but in all the different models that you were using, and I appreciate them, in the Bible, there's an enemy of both God and man. It's the devil, Satan. And is there any role in any of the therapy or counseling? Does the devil, does Satan have anything to do with any of this? Is it just the person's, you know, weaknesses or impulses or temptations and God? But is there a devil involved here somewhere? And if there is, how do you deal with that?
Yeah, it's a great question. The way that I look at this is when I talk about the fall, for example, that's where I would locate influences that are not from God. So the devil's influences from the fallen condition. See, one thing I would, when we think about sin, I would make a distinction between sin as things that we do or fail to do. That's common in evangelical circles, is to focus on things we do and don't do. But sin is also a state or condition that we're all in. And so it's then difficult to tease out what in that state and condition. Do I sin because I'm a sinful person, or am I a sinful person because of my patterns of sin? I mean, both of those things coexist. So I think of this, of evil, of a theodicy, as a part of the fallen condition primarily. Now, if people work with me and come from a background where they think they conceptualize it as there's a spiritual battle here, they're probably going to see it more around that script. That script feels to them like it's infused with deceptive statements that they need to combat. I just don't conceptualize it that way, but I function in a very limited sphere as the kind of profession I'm in. But if I was a pastor who used that conceptual framework and was doing pastoral care and saw the script itself as being infused with distortions and lies, then I could see where that way of thinking about it would really augment, you know, that understanding. It's just not the role that I'm in.
Okay, good. Thank you very much.
You have been listening to another special American Christian Ministries presentation. This is a digital recording for optimum sound quality. International copyright 2009, all rights reserved. To order a copy of this or other presentations, or for a free catalog, please call toll-free 800-233-4450. International calls dial 717-652-7000. You may also order from our secure website at www.americanchristianministry.org. There you will discover the largest selection of authentic Adventist preaching available. You can trust ACM. There's no compromise here. If American Christian Ministries has been a blessing to you, why not take a moment just now and send us a note or an email with your testimony? We'll share it with the speakers and volunteer workers to encourage them. Your prayers and continued financial support are very important to ensure the continuation of this ministry, as we help prepare America and the world to meet Jesus Christ. He is coming soon.